Welcome to Boston Confidential, Beantown's true crime podcast. Boston is a great city, but there's more to it than the Freedom Trail and Fenway Park. There's a startling underbelly to the city, and Boston Confidential will take you on a guided tour of the hub of the universe, Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Boston Confidential. My name's Barry McGuire, and I'm your host. I'm a 20-year private investigator on the streets of Boston, and I help run a company called Impact Due Diligence Investigations. If you need anything in terms of investigative services, feel free to contact me at Impact. If I can't help you personally, I'll certainly direct you to the right person or agency. Hey guys, welcome back to Boston Confidential. Just some housekeeping stuff as we usually do before each episode. We had a great response to our last episode on the Lady of the Dunes. She had been identified, and quite frankly, I didn't think that was going to ever happen. Ruth Marie Terry is the Lady of the Dunes. She was from Tennessee and really had no connection to Massachusetts, and I think that's what kept the family from pinpointing this missing person, this body found in Provincetown, as their loved one. It's just a horrible case, and it seems as though the police and FBI are looking at Guy Rockwell Moldavin. This is Ruth's husband. They had married the previous February. And this guy seems pretty slippery to me. He was a suspect in a double homicide of his wife and stepdaughter. He did have a charge in that case. It wasn't for the murders. It was like fleeing the jurisdiction. One of those laws they had on the books back then. He returned to the jurisdiction eventually and was never charged with the homicides. This guy Moldavin went by several different names, as did Ruth Marie Terry, which leads me to believe that they were living outside of the law. And that may be some of the reasons she was not in contact with her family in Tennessee. So that's three homicides in this guy Rockwell Moldavin's orbit. How many homicides are in your orbit? You know what I mean? Okay, guys, we're on to a tough one today. And this case had been recommended to me several times, most recently by Victoria, a friend of the show from Winchester, Massachusetts. Victoria's complaining that not much happens here in Winchester. And I had to reply, well, that's a good thing. This one thing did happen in Winchester, Massachusetts. It is not a reflection on the community. Winchester is a beautiful town located, 8-10 miles north of Boston. But Vicky, this is the case you suggested, so here it is. It's a tough one, and I'm going to have to give everybody, and not just Vicky, a warning here. This is one of the most brutal cases we've ever covered on Boston Confidential. And this is the case of Thomas Mortimer and his family back in June 2010. And this episode, I'm afraid, is going to feature violence against women, violence against children, and the most horrific forms of homicide that you'll probably ever hear about. So if you can't handle violence against children and women, please, this may not be the episode for you. Boston Confidential does have some other episodes that may be more up your alley, but this is your only warning, and this is Boston Confidential. So guys, I guess we don't really have to jump into the Wayback Machine on this episode. It was 2010, but saying that, man, it seems like a long time ago now. You know, it's more than a decade. So let me tell you a little bit about Winchester, Massachusetts. It's about 8-9 miles from the city. It is a truly suburban community, and it is gorgeous. It's expensive due to its proximity to Boston. Actually, you have a great commute into the city of Boston. Like I said, it was only 8 miles or so. But even at that time, if it's regular rush hour, it's an hour into the city. That has to make you pull your hair out. But beautiful community, definitely commutable into the city. But the technology belt at 128 is right there. I believe Winchester on one side, Route 128 technology belt in that area. So you could go to Route 128 for work, and a lot of people did, and the other direction, south to Boston. And it is a beautiful community, and Vicky's right. Not a hell of a lot crime-wise happens there. Mostly a bedroom community. And when this happened in 2010, there wasn't a hell of a lot going on in downtown Winchester. But now there's a lot of high-end restaurants and things to do in the town and the surrounding towns, which are equally as beautiful. You don't have to go into the city and deal with the parking and all this. You can go right to downtown Winchester. This is a beautiful season in Winchester. It's like Norman Rockwellville, I mean, with the leaves, and it's just beautiful. And now we're getting ready for Christmas, so it's a beautiful area. I can't say enough about it. I live to the Metropolitan West section of Boston, and if I had to go north, it would probably be Winchester, Woburn, if I had to do that. And the only place I'm really going is further south where it gets warm, but other than that, Winchester, beautiful community, and this was the choice of the Mortimer family in 2010. So Winchester has always been pretty well-to-do. It's a pretty well-heeled suburb. The Mortimers lived in a beautiful colonial owned by Ragna Ellen Stone. She was kind of the matriarch of this family. And that was Thomas Mortimer's mother-in-law. Now, Thomas was 43 years old, and his wife was named Laura Stone Mortimer. And Ragna was Laura's mom, and they lived with her for about 5 years at this place. I believe it's on Winsong Lane in Winchester, Massachusetts. It's beautiful. Like I said, it's always been pricey. I've looked at some homes on Winsong Lane just in research for this podcast, and the homes, they're regular colonials, older colonials, and the price on that one, their old colonial, currently was $1.6 million. So I wouldn't pay for that, but that's what they're getting in Winchester now. And even when the Mortimers moved in, I believe Ragna had lived there for quite some time, and they moved in and, you know, they were trying to get their lives started. So the Mortimer family consisted of Thomas Mortimer. He was age 43 and he had been in sales for quite some time. And during this time in 2010, he had been out of work for about 18 months, but had just gotten another job in the metropolitan Boston area leading a sales team. And he seemed to be very good at it. And the wife, Laura Stone Mortimer, she was an economist in Boston, and she worked for a commercial real estate firm. So I think she was doing pretty well financially. I think Thomas had a letdown. He had been laid off 18 months prior, so things weren't probably going very well for him. And living with Ragna, that's your mother-in-law. It's her colonial. It's not yours. So there's got to be a bit of stress there. So as I had said, they had lived with Ragna in Winchester for about 5 years prior to 2010. And in the interim, they had two kids, Charlotte, who was age 2, and Thomas Finn Mortimer. And he went by the nickname Finn. And he was 4 years old. These kids, just looking at them, it's complete sunshine. 2 and 4, who could ask for anything more? All they do is look up to mom and dad, and everything's new to them. And I'm going to post some pictures of these kids and Laura as well. And it just seemed to be a beautiful family. But what was going on the inside of this family? Well, that was one thing. And outward appearances, you would think, you know, beautiful colonial in Winchester. This guy's at the executive level. He's a sales executive, just got another kick-ass job. The wife is working in downtown Boston as an economist in the real estate, commercial real estate field. You know, the money would get better, you know, so I don't know. It's seemingly not enough of a stressor for me to see what would be coming next. And what would be coming next is pure and unadulterated horror. And these people simply weren't in the demographic to think that something horrible like this would happen in their lives, something horrible and intentional. We all suffer accidents and tragedies, but this is intentional, and they're just not in that demographic, right? They don't seemingly do drugs. They don't seemingly have an alcohol problem. They're not down with gambling in the area, things that would get you in trouble with not only the police in Metro Boston, but people outside the law, right? There are people in that demographic, and they get shot on a weekly basis here in Massachusetts, and more so in other parts of the country, right? These Mortimers, Thomas Mortimer and his family, they simply weren't in that demographic. And honestly, guys, that kind of adds to the horror in all this. And I'm just going to have to tell the story at a certain point. But like I say about demographics, Thomas Mortimer grew up in Avon, Connecticut. And that seemingly is a suburb of Hartford. It is south of Simsbury and kind of north of Bristol, so central Connecticut, I think. And again, it's just an all-American community. And this guy Mortimer, Thomas Mortimer IV, he kind of led that everyday suburban life. It's absolutely crazy what would happen next. Let me tell you the facts surrounding this case, and you're going to have to brace yourself, okay? So it is June 14th, 2010. It's a Monday, and seemingly an everyday for this family in Winchester, Massachusetts. During this day, seemingly Thomas Mortimer is at work a little later than Laura, and Laura gets home, and her mother's there with the two children. And it is said that Thomas's parents had come up from Connecticut to help babysit. And one of the things in this story that doesn't really jibe with me was because Ragna, the grandmother and mother-in-law on Laura's side, was living there, but they needed Thomas's parents to come up from Avon, Connecticut to help babysit. So I found that a little strange. That's about a 2-hour trip from Avon, Connecticut, up to Massachusetts, but I don't know all the details on it. And the parents were there. Thomas gets home from after work time, and Laura's already there. Laura's gotten the mail, and she's going through the mail, and she notices a letter from the IRS. Keep in mind, they'd been having some tax trouble, as Thomas had been out of work for more than a year during the previous months. So they had owed the IRS, and they had written them a check for almost $2,500, and that had bounced. And Laura was visibly upset and put the letter down. And when Thomas came home, his parents were there, and Laura's mom, Ragna, was there. She lived there. So the whole family was there, and Laura kind of confronts Thomas to his face in front of the rest of the family and asks about the bounced check for the IRS. Thomas, I could tell you, probably felt like shit, right? And says, okay, everybody's hungry. Let's just eat, and we'll talk about that later. Seemingly, that did the trick. They went on to have a nice dinner with the children, Ragna, and the other set of in-laws. So on the surface, it seemed to kind of dissipate. And being out of work for an extended period like that, you're going to incur some debts. And to be honest with you, I don't know what the living situation was like with funds or whatever. I believe it was Ragna's colonial that they lived in Winchester. But they may have been working some type of deal where Thomas and Laura would eventually buy the house, she'd live there, or, you know, move. I don't know. Ragna was 64 at the time. But I think Thomas was kind of taken aback. Laura was a little bit aggressive with this, basically talking about debt collection in front of people. And that kind of set Thomas off. After dinner, again, they say dinner was fine with everybody and everybody's getting along. After dinner, Thomas's parents leave at about 8:45, it says, to drive back to Connecticut. Again, that seems odd, right? Ragnar was like 64, and I'm assuming Thomas's parents had to have been about the same age. I don't know if I'd send my 60-something-year-old parents out of my house at 9 p.m. to drive 2 hours back home. Why not just stay the night and get an early rise the next day? You know what I mean? So those are some things, some question marks I see out there, and this is just as the story goes. But Thomas was infuriated by this question about the bounce check to the IRS. And sometime after the parents leave about 9 o'clock, sometime between 9:05 p.m. and 7:10 a.m. The next day would be June 15th, the unspeakable and the unthinkable happened. So apparently Thomas and Laura continued their discussion in the kitchen after Thomas's parents had left. And I do believe it was closer to that 9 p.m. hour than the 7 a.m. hour of the next day, because I just think that's how it went, you know. But I'm not entirely sure. This is how I see it, and I've read every account on it. A lot of the accounts of the actual event in this case are watered down, but I did find an actual sequence of events, and seemingly the newspapers outside of the United States do a much better job at crime reporting than inside the United States. But okay, so let's just take it, say, 9 p.m. on June 14, 2010. Thomas Mortimer bids his parents goodbye at the door. Again, a bit of a strange occurrence in my mind, but there may be other reasons behind it. So Thomas goes back in, and obviously him and Laura start to talk about the IRS thing. At a certain point, somebody puts the baby, Charlotte, she was 2 years old, up to bed. It was after dinner, you know, she had to go to bed. And Finn and Ragnar were downstairs. But as Thomas was talking to his wife, Laura, he lost it. He completely lost it. He picked up a frying pan from the stove and smashed Laura in the head repeatedly. At this point, guys, he grabs a knife and stabs her in the head, neck, and torso more than 60 times. Just from that outburst, you can see that there's a level of animosity there that you really can't contend with. And this guy, Thomas Mortimer, he was the most milquetoast guy you could ever think about, right? This case kind of reminds me of the case of Kenneth Seguin in Boston's Metro West section. Milquetoast, workaday guy, lovely family, and he turns out to be a family annihilator. So it does remind me of that case a little bit. It got a little less publicity than that because Seguin's kids were missing for a period. But let me stick to this story. So he begins to bludgeon Laura with this frying pan, and he seemingly loses his mind, and he starts to stab her, and it was a frenzy of violence. And I think, honestly, it was a long time coming, and nothing Laura or anybody in that family could do would ever justify what Thomas Mortimer did to his wife. But I'm sorry to say, guys, it didn't end there. And now this guy, I don't know. I don't know what he's thinking at this moment, but if it's a second per stab, right, per stab wound, that's over a minute where he's in this frenzy. And at a certain point, it is believed that Ragnar, Laura's mother, starts screaming. She comes into the kitchen and sees this mess. She doesn't know what's going on. And she tries to hightail it out the door. And guys, she makes it out the door. But Thomas Mortimer follows her out, grabs her by the hair, and drags her back into the family room. And he stabs her to death in a vicious manner. And there's another person, I'm afraid. There's another person in this family room. And it was little Finn, 4 years old. And he had witnessed all of this. He had witnessed his mother being butchered. And then his grandmother having the same fate. And, this poor baby. And at this point, guys, Thomas Mortimer takes the knife he had used on these two helpless women and used this knife to cut his baby, Thomas Finn Mortimer. He used it to cut his throat, guys. And he did that. And that baby died pretty quick, like they can't handle much blood loss. So that poor baby. And at that point, guys, this guy, this man, this monster, Thomas Mortimer, goes upstairs to the crib of his beautiful 2-year-old girl, Charlotte, who is screaming in her crib, and he cuts her throat. And the coroner would later say that baby Charlotte was standing up, face forward, looking at her father as he used a knife to cut her throat. So a few things happen after this horrendous crime. This guy goes from sales manager at a computer firm to a family annihilator. What did that take? Under 5 minutes, I would bet, right? 5 minutes of madness. So then what? Sometime during the night, and I don't know what order it goes in, but he writes 2 confession letters, one on the computer and one that was handwritten. You know, he confessed to doing all of this, and he said how he did it and all that. He then, at some point, attempted suicide in the garage with having garden hose or garden hoses from his exhaust into his motor vehicle in the garage. He had some vodka in there and some weapons. I don't know if it was the weapon he used on the kids and the wife, but he attempted to asphyxiate himself with carbon monoxide. And somehow, again, this guy doesn't get the job done and leaves the residence at a certain point. But before he departs, he calls into work sick. Can you imagine that? This lunatic calls into his workplace where he just started this job and said he wasn't feeling well. And later he calls into Finn. Finn was due to go to preschool that morning and also called him out sick. During this time frame, Thomas also answered Laura's cell phone. Laura's sister was calling her early in the morning because they had plans. So when Thomas answered the phone, he said to Laura's sister, "Yeah, it's going to be a while before you talk to her." He made up some excuse, but that was an awful thing to say. But this guy is just, he's an absolute monster. And then he leaves Winchester and he seemingly goes west into western Massachusetts. But just prior to heading west, he threw his cell phone out of the car. I'm assuming he did this because he knew police would track it pretty easily. He threw it out at about 1:33 in Andover. And I believe at that point he headed west. He had no cell phone or anything at that point. But Laura's sister, at a certain point, was just dismayed with that phone call that she had with Thomas Mortimer. He had picked up her cell phone, which he had never done before, and said, "It'll be a while before you can speak with her," or something like that. And the sister knew what Laura's schedule was, and, well, why can't she? But he hangs up and goes about his business. But she's dismayed by it and heads down to the house in Winchester. And she gets there and she can see blood through the foyer of the home, I believe. And she calls, she activates EMS, police and fire, and they both show up. And I think they force entry and they believe it could be a medical situation at that point. So rescue goes in and they see that horror show I just described to you. So this is on the 16th, guys, when the bodies were discovered, June 16th. And they entered the home and they saw that carnage that I had described, but they saw that the grandmother was covered with an oriental rug. I don't know if Mortimer had done anything else to the other bodies, but they say that Laura was just completely savaged. Her nose and face was smashed in from that frying pan, and he had just really eviscerated her with that knife right in the head, right in the face, and it was horrible. And all the while, Finn, little Finn, 4 years old, sees it all. And Dad, at that point, could have just stormed out and called the police himself. You know, go jump off the Tobin, right? Couldn't do it. Takes care of the rest of the family, and it's just insane. Like I said, guys, there's two confession letters, and there's just no question about guilt in this. So I hope I didn't make you think that this was some type of mystery. It isn't. It's just horror. So the police see they have a quadruple homicide in sleepy little Winchester, Massachusetts. And man, when I tell you, this is about when it hit the news. And they started looking for Thomas Mortimer the IV pretty quickly. And they actually had sent the Connecticut State Police to Avon, Connecticut, to see if Thomas Mortimer would show up at his parents' house. They still lived in the same house that they had raised Thomas in. They never did. And while they were there, the police had interviewed some neighbors and they'd later go on to talk to reporters, and they just described Mortimer's parents as like solid people, salt of the earth, you know? And the parents had done no wrong in this, and nobody could figure out why any of this was happening. But Thomas Mortimer was on the loose, and the police were, you know, activating SWAT teams and all this other stuff. It was crazy. So I believe it hit the news on the afternoon of the 16th, and Mortimer was still on the loose. And it was an ongoing thing on the news, a continuous loop looking for this Thomas Mortimer. And it was plastered on every TV, all over the internet, all over the state, I'm sure all over the country. So I believe it is on the 16th, you know, this guy is still on the loose. The news pretty quickly turns against Mortimer, and he is obviously the sole person of interest in all this because he had spoken to Laura's sister last, so they knew he was alive, and the police were obviously focused on him. And he had thrown his cell phone out, and it was believed he headed west. It was on June 17th that this guy was finally apprehended in Hubbardston by a father and son duo. So father and son were in Hubbardston. They pull over to do a good deed. And the guy behind the wheel of the other vehicle is Mr. Mortimer. And the father had been watching the news, so he calls Hubbardston PD. I believe this guy must have headed out Route 2 west because you wouldn't have to deal with those tolls or anything like that. So seemingly with Mortimer throwing his cell phone out the window and trying to avoid the toll tracking system, right? He's seemingly trying to get away, but maybe it's a half-hearted attempt, I don't know. So these two good citizens call in to the Hubbardston police, and Hubbardston puts out an APB, and this Jamoke is finally caught in Bernardston, Massachusetts. It's way out west, and it's a beautiful section of Massachusetts, but it's a very small town. They take this guy into custody without incident, and he almost immediately confesses. He gets back to, I don't know if they take him to the state police barracks or Bernardston public safety or whatever, but when he calls his mother, they allow him one call. I think pretty quickly he says, I'm going to confess. He wanted to just talk to his mother first. And she asked him if he had just, you know, flipped out. And he said, yeah, basically. And the police heard him confess to all this. And he was apologetic and depressed and all this. But almost immediately, like I said, he confessed to mom, and then he went in with the detectives and confessed to them as well. So I guess that was a crazy couple of days, right? From the 14th through the 17th, this evil just comes out of nowhere. It's hard to fathom. So I know you're wondering, what's in the letters? What is the reasoning behind this? And I'll tell it to you like I see it here. He wrote it down, so I guess we know. So here it is. There's actually a good article on this in the Journal Inquirer, and I'll post that in the show notes, but I'm going to read from it a little bit. The reporter's name on this story is J. Lindsay, Associated Press, 2010. So J. Lindsay of Associated Press says, in his letter, allegedly written in the hours after the June killings, Mortimer moves between confession and self-pity, writing, what have I done? I hate myself more than ever. Also, I wonder what life would be like if I did not chicken out. I think he means by suicide on that. He wrote, it would have been better to write about his wife's family instead of bottling up my anger, frustration, resentment, and hatred and letting it fester until one murderous night. He also expressed shock and relief at what he had done. I am ashamed, frightened, relieved, surprised that I murdered my family, disgusted with myself. The statement didn't include four lines from the original statement of the case, which had remained sealed. Also in his letter, Mortimer wrote, I did these horrible things because I could not cope with the responsibilities I took upon myself. He wrote he should have divorced his wife and been a good role model for his children. But he also wrote that he couldn't envision things getting better and said he believes they are in a much better place than they ever could be living with Laura and living with me. He added he was looking forward to peace, but was already missing terribly Finn and Charlotte. That will be my hell. So it seems like, guys, that this Thomas Mortimer IV had a beef with his wife's family, and it was known among his intimate circle that they were having marital problems. But again, this guy's milquetoast. He's just a nice guy. That's how everybody described him. And I think if this woman asked for a divorce, everybody thought he'd just grant it. And he was out of work for that time, and I don't know. He seems to have a problem. The hatred he seems to talk about is focused on his wife, because obviously look what he did with the frying pan and knife, right? And her family. So I don't know if they were on his ass for being out of work or whatever else, but man, whatever they did or he perceived that they did to him was not worthy of what he did to them. He could have just packed a bag, gave him the finger, and walked out the door, right? It happens all the time. And now your kids would probably be college graduates and out on their own. And yeah, you got a divorce. In a lot of people's lives, I see even the relationship between the spouses improve when there's some space between them. They obviously both had picked the wrong partner. It would come out later that Mortimer would claim that he suffered from depression, much like that Kenneth Seguin case out of Holliston, Massachusetts that I mentioned previously. But I don't know, man. It's just such a crazy turn of events. There's nothing anybody could tell me in this universe that this guy didn't deserve the death penalty. Why isn't this guy in the electric chair? All right, I know I'm getting ahead of myself because I haven't even given you the verdict. The only thing that this guy, Thomas Mortimer, had done right in this whole thing is he didn't try to escape blame. He confessed that day to the police. He confessed, he was arraigned, and he later just pled guilty to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. No trial, no nothing. He admitted what he had done. why he had done it, how he had done it. There's just no question of guilt here. Why isn't he in the electric chair? It's just not enough. It's simply not enough punishment for this guy to wake up every morning and see the sun above him. It's not enough after what he did to those beautiful children, to his beautiful wife, for no reason. You could have just walked out. You could have left with mom and dad. Hey, I'm going back to Connecticut, right? And things would have been much better in the next year, right? But instead, you turned evil. Absolutely evil. How could you do that? How could you do that madness? Four people extinguished from this earth, and this guy just goes off to a jail cell. It's simply not enough. Not enough punishment. Also in his note, and I believe in his conversations with police, he went on to say that his wife and her side of the family were like overbearing on him. And that's what he attributes all this to. I believe that's what he was talking about when he said hatred. In a portion of the letter, he stated words to the effect that he should have written a book about his wife's dysfunctional family instead of doing what he did. So this is the only report I've come across as Thomas Mortimer's account of his wife's family. He impugns their integrity, says, you know, basically they're not good people, they don't treat them well. Nobody else echoes that statement. I want to make that clear. Could it be true? Perhaps. Is this guy just a lunatic? Most certainly. So he pled guilty, I believe, to all those life sentences. And I've looked him up. He is in medium security prison at the Old Colony Correctional Center in Massachusetts. Medium security, guys. You think you're out busting rocks? Because you're not. He's probably a member of that Life is Club up there where they do all this inmate handholding and let us out of prison BS. Ask this to the people out there spouting, let's get rid of prisons, let's get rid of police. What do you do with Thomas Mortimer? Is he going to live next to you? Is he going to live next to me? Man, that's progress, right? He's still in the joint. The only good thing this guy did in any of this was confess to it. So I just don't understand any of it. It's total madness. All right, guys, to my corrections officers crew out there, and there are several of them who listen to Boston Confidential, let me know if you've come across Thomas Mortimer up at the Old Colony Correctional Center and how Mr. Mortimer is making out these days. I know he's still in the joint and thankfully he'll be for the rest of his life, but I think that's all I have for you on this one. It was a tough one to get through. If you made it this far, you're a real champion. So give yourself some credit. But I'm going to leave you there on this one. Mr. Mortimer is still in the joint. He should be in the electric chair. And if you want to tell me otherwise, drop me an email at barry@bostonconfidential.net. Otherwise, I'll get on to the next one for you. See you on the flip side, guys.